TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Michael Parenti, Terrorism and Globalization. Michael Parenti is one of the country's most prolific political thinkers and a highly popular public speaker. He authored 15 books on topics such as history, fascism, U.S. imperialism, globalism, and terrorism. He received his Ph.D. in political science from Yale in 1962. After a teaching career, he now lives in California and is a full-time writer and lecturer. You are about to hear excerpts from one of his most cherished recent speeches, his 2002 Santa Cruz talk on terrorism and globalization. He raises and answers questions such as, is the U.S. an imperial nation? Is capitalism good for the world? How does U.S. colonialism differ from that of Great Britain? And ultimately, who are the real terrorists? Here is Michael Parenti receiving a rousing welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I have a Ph.D. in political science, and it occurred to me that I never studied imperialism in all those years from grade school on. Oh, I heard about British imperialism and the Roman Empire and Soviet imperialism, which was going to take over the world. But U.S. imperialism, the term would horrify some of our fellow citizens who apparently trust everything their leaders say. I'm not one of those people who thinks that U.S. foreign policy is all mixed up, that it's all confused. Imperialism is really the real harsher word for what is now called globalization. And what it really is the expansionist form of capitalism, of giant corporate capitalism. You got to make that clear. We're talking about the giant corporations. Because when I launch into criticisms about capitalism, I immediately get people, there are always people sloshing in bathos and start talking about, what about the mom and pop business, and they struggle and they build it up and they create some jobs from some other people. Ooh. And I go, ooh, nice. So we're not talking about that. We're talking about these giant multi-billion dollar corporations that are not adding a little something to the community, but carving up whole continents and destroying our ecology. That's what we're talking about. Can we talk about that? Giant corporate capitalism. So that's what I mean whenever I say capitalism, not mom and pop and small businesses, nice little bookstores, which I want to support too. Now, we are taught a few things about capitalism. We're taught that it's a system that works, and we're taught that it's brought us prosperity, that capitalism creates prosperity. I am going to argue against that hypothesis tonight. One. Two, I'm going to convince you that that hypothesis is wrong. Three, I'm going to do that in the next 5 or 10 seconds. Almost the entire world is capitalist, and almost the entire world is poor. There you are. I'm coming to this other thing that I'm using that the media usually doesn't use. It's called evidence. Look at the world. Most of the world is capitalist. There's capitalist Indonesia. It's miserably poor and getting poorer. There's capitalist India. There's capitalist Thailand. Capitalist Nigeria, El Salvador, Haiti, Mexico, Brazil, capitalist Argentina, which is falling apart and unraveling, capitalist Russia, Poland, Bulgaria, privatization, third worldization. Poor, poor. The number of people living in poverty today is growing at a faster rate than the world's population. That is capitalism's expansion. That's capitalism's prosperity that it's bringing. capitalism does not work quite well for the people in those countries. Now, that is also capitalism at its most successful, because capitalism in Indonesia works quite well for the capitalists. It's just the people aren't doing too well. Well, okay, gee, I hadn't thought of it. And we never think of those countries as being capitalist, too. Yeah, all right, it doesn't work so well for the common people of those third world countries, but it's given us a good standard of living. Well, that, too, I'm going to refute. It's going to take maybe a little longer than 5 seconds, maybe 20, 25 seconds. In this country, let's put aside the mass inequalities. Let's put aside the tens of millions of people who struggle from hand to mouth. Let's put aside the many who live without real economic security, which might include many of us. Let's put aside the desperate ones at the very bottom. Let's even put aside the middle-class people who are getting ripped off left and right with their taxes and overwork and loss of benefits and the like. Let's put aside the impoverishment of the public sector and the destruction of a livable environment. Let's accept the idea that we live in great material abundance, which, in fact, compared to much of the world, we do. Many in this country do live well. But it wasn't capitalism that gave us this standard of living. It was the democratic struggle against capitalism. They didn't give us all these things. I mean, why don't we Americans work for 15 cents an hour as they do in Haiti, in Indonesia? Is it because we're just so much more self-respecting? Is that it? No. It's because the democratic class struggle has advanced to a more favorable level. And that's happened only in the last few generations. In 1900, America was a third world country, half a century before the term was invented. We were a third world nation. Child labor was widespread. Poverty was widespread, 14-hour workdays, 10-year-olds working in factories for 14 hours, 7 days a week, no social services to speak of, a few church soup kitchens and charities maybe, no social benefits, typhoid epidemics in our major cities, tuberculosis and other diseases of poverty, no public housing or public health programs, very little public education, no public libraries, really. Advances came not with capitalism. That's what the country was, a pure, free market, unregulated, undiluted capitalism in 1900, but massive margins of profit, huge margins of profit, massive, massive, massive wealth for the Mellons and the Morgans and the Huntingtons and the Hartfords and the Rockefellers and the Carnegies and the Vanderbilts, more money than they knew what to do with. And you know what they wanted after they got that money? They wanted more, and they wanted more, and they would destroy whole communities to get more and more and more. Wealth, my friends, wealth is the most damaging and the most dangerous addiction that this society faces. It was the people, it was the American people, it was the working people in this country who fought and fought for the 8-hour day, who fought for public education, who fought for public health services. It was the people who fought for decent housing and a decent standard of living, who fought for a minimum wage, who have fought against discrimination. Name one great leader, name one great political leader, name one great intellectual who fought and did those things. No, those people, they jumped on the bandwagon after the people fought. And it was the plutocrats, it was the capitalists, it was the economic royalists who fought against every one of those things. They fought against giving you a decent wage. They're still fighting against that. They're still fighting for wage cuts. They fought against Social Security. They fought against occupational safety. They're still fighting against it. They fought against environmental protections. They still are fighting against it, undermining it every way they can, because they're afraid they're going to lose out on a dollar. Because every dollar they've got to give to you, every dollar they've got to spend on stupid things like public safety and wages and occupational safety and consumer product safety. Every dollar wasted on stupid things like that, which the free market would take care of. Every dollar spent on that is one less dollar for their insatiable greed. And that's it. So don't credit the capitalists for giving you whatever modicum of prosperity you have. We got it despite it. We tore it out of their teeth and out of their greedy claws. And we still got to hold on to it, and they're trying to get it back from us. It wasn't capitalism that brought these advances. It was democracy. It was the people in action. It was class struggle. Class struggle, my friends, is one of the major and central expressions of democracy. That's what class struggle is about. When they get up, you know, they do class warfare on us all the time. Taxes, tax cuts for the rich, this, that. They're always doing class war on us. The minute we rally and we start attacking this corporate rich, they say, oh, you're preaching class warfare. George Bush, George the First used to say that. The minute we start to fight back or answer back, oh, you're preaching class warfare. I have another name for that. It is class struggle. It is class warfare. The other name for it, when people become the active social agents of their own lives and go out and protest and try to better their lives, that another name for that is called democracy. And they wouldn't recognize it if you slap them right in the face with it. They wouldn't know what it is. And it was these economic royalists, the rich bankers, the merchant class, the slaveholders, they fought against political democracy as well as economic democracy. They fought against the elimination of property qualifications for voters and office holders. After all, they put that into the laws. They put that into the laws, those property qualifications. Those were their laws. They fought against extending the vote, universal suffrage for working men in the 1820s and 30s. They fought against suffrage for women. They fought against the abolition of slavery and Jim Crow. They fought against honest elections and democratic ballot access and proportional representation and campaign finance reform and securing civil liberties. And they're still fighting against it. Do you have the evidence? Have I proven my case? Just go out and look at it all. That's what they're doing. Political and economic democracy are the things that they fear the most. Democracy is always under siege and always endangered by plutocracy. So when we say that capitalism works or it doesn't work, we must specify for whom. Because capitalism doesn't work all that well. Giant corporate finance capital doesn't work all that well for third world nations. It doesn't work all that well for other people. But it works quite well for the capitalists. The rate of capital accumulation per dollar invested is much higher in third world countries. The public sector is smaller or non-existent. Regulation is less, non-existent in many cases. The goal is to get us all back to the third world. The dream is to get all of North America and Denmark and Sweden and Western Europe and such, get it all back, get them all working as hard as the people do in Indonesia. Oh, who's going to buy all this stuff? Oh, you'll buy. You may have to buy less. You just have to work twice as hard to buy. Do you work twice as hard to buy that pair of shoes? I make that much more on those shoes. So they're working very hard to get us back to 1900. To achieve all this, the U.S. globalists have been the greatest purveyors of state-sponsored terrorism the world has ever seen. U.S. national security state has supported and financed Muslim terrorists in Afghanistan, in Bosnia and Kosovo, against a democratically and elected multi-party Yugoslavian government in Bosnia and Kosovo, in various other countries. U.S. operatives have worked with death squads, torturers, drug traffickers in countries too numerous to list here. All of this is a matter of public record. All of it is largely ignored by the corporate media. Very little of it is known by the general public. Since World War II, the U.S. national security state has been a key force in overthrowing popular governments in Guatemala, Guyana, Brazil, Chile, Iran under Mossadegh, Uruguay, Syria, Indonesia under Sukarno, Greece twice, Argentina twice, Haiti, Bolivia, and other countries too numerous to mention. And replacing them with pro-capitalist military regimes that opened up their markets, their resources, their cheap labor to Western corporate investors on terms that were completely favorable to the investors. In those years, the U.S. has launched terrorist, state-sponsored terrorist attacks and proxy mercenary wars in Angola, 2 million dead, Mozambique, 900,000 killed, the Renamo murderers, CIA trained and financed. How many of us read large, copious, penetrating articles about these things? Did the media provide that for us? I don't think so. Ethiopia, Portugal, South Yemen, Nicaragua, Cambodia, East Timor, Western Sahara, Egypt, Lebanon, Peru, Iran, Zaire, Jamaica, the Fiji Islands, and other countries. These lists are not exhaustive. I'm just giving you the names I jotted down from my own memory. In the last 3 decades, U.S. forces have launched aerial attacks or direct military actions with U.S. forces. Now we're talking about U.S. missiles, U.S. forces, not just U.S. weapons in the hands of mercenary or comprador groups, but U.S. forces directly. In violation of U.N. charter and international law, including invasions against Vietnam, Dominican Republic, North Korea, invasions or attacks, I'm saying, Laos, Cambodia, Haiti, Lebanon, Grenada, Panama, Iraq, Somalia, Afghanistan, and Yugoslavia. There's no rogue state. There's no communist state that has a record like that. In these last 3 decades, the number of countries invaded, bombed, large numbers of people killed and destroyed. When there's no evil Axis country that has this record of violent aggression, mass destruction, and violation of international law. Today, the U.S. neocolonial empire, and you understand the difference between imperialism and neo-imperialism, our empire, the British Empire, when I was a kid, you used to take a globe and you could see all this pink all over the globe. That was the British Empire. And you say, my gosh, where you went and you planted the Union Jack and all that. 50 years before the Brits thought of doing this in India, the U.S. had devised a new form of imperialism. And they did it in Cuba. In about 1902, they went to Cuba, 1904, and they said, look, we just stole you fair and square from the Spaniards, who were willing to negotiate a settlement and leave, but we didn't want them to leave. We wanted to have a war so we could have an excuse to take not only Cuba, but Puerto Rico and Guam and the Philippines. So we got you now, but it doesn't look so good. We're a republic having colonies. In fact, I never had colonies. Another thing, when I was a kid in school, they were called territories. The U.S. had territories, different places. So what we're going to do is we're going to give you Cubans your independence. We're going to give you your own constitution. In fact, here it is. And check the spelling because our Spanish isn't that good. And you're going to have your own presidente, and you're going to have your own currency, money, and you can put anybody you want on the dollar bills. You can put Jose Marti if you want. It doesn't have to be George Washington. Hey, we're flex. You're going to have your own flag. It's going to be red, white, and blue. But you have only one star on it because you're just a little island. And all we get in return, in our usual selfless way, is we will just own your sugar industry, your tobacco industry, your nickel mining, your oil refineries, and we'll control all your exports and imports, and we have control of all your relations with third nations. So you're independent now. There you go. They did that, you know, they did that half a century before the British thought of doing it. So we have these, all these independent countries whose militaries we support, whose markets we control, who we can bring to their knees with the threat of sanctions and the like. 300 major military bases all over the world. We need them, Dick Cheney says, we need them because there are other enemies. With the overthrow of communism, there was a sudden panic, an enemy shortage they had in Washington. What do we do? Because the only way the empire can exist, the empire exists by feeding off the republic. It uses the resources of the republic so that patricians can pursue their far-off plunder. They need your taxes, they need your resources, they need your sons and daughters so that they can go and do these things. And to do that, the only way they can do that is by convincing you this is for your interest, your security, your safety, because there's a world out there of terrible threats and such. U.S. leaders have been destroying democratic movements throughout the Middle East, in Syria, in Egypt, in Yemen, in Iran, in Iraq. Democratic popular movements in Turkey, country after country, one country after another, those democratic movements have been repressed. The only channel they've got left is this Islamic, ultra-nationalist, right-wing expression. And that's the route they take. And so then we American citizens, we become the targets of their terrorism, as happened a year ago, September 11. Now that September 11, which many of us looked at and saw it as a horrible event, the people who are running this country now looked at that as a golden opportunity. That's not my speculation. On September 14, I heard President-elect George Bush say, I heard him say, this may prove to be an opportunity, a really important opportunity. Remember those wonderful things he was saying? It's going to be the first war of the 21st century. The first war, yay! Instead of saying this should be a century of no war, or this should be the last war, or let's try to avoid war in this new century, saying this is going to be the first war and something to look forward to, all those other wars. And this has defined my administration now. He saw the peg, he saw this opening. Now, the goal of all this imperialism is a very consistent and very rational goal. The countries, the movements, the leaders that are acted against are those who try to develop things in a different way. The countries, the movements, and the leaders who get U.S. support are those who foster the interests of the Fortune 500. The basic struggle is between those who think that the land, the labor, the resources, the natural resources, and the markets of the world should be there for the benefit of capital accumulation, for the benefit of a few, as against those who think that the land, the labor, and the natural resources and the capital of the world should be there for the development of human communities and human needs. That is the basic struggle that's going on here. The goal now, with the overthrow of communism, the goal now is to prevent also competing centers of capitalist development. The goal now is to really stick it to the working classes of all these countries that have won all these democratic gains, many of which the plutocrats have had to give them out of fear of communism. So just to sell it to them, to say, you know, see, you've got so much better life than the people over there in those countries do. You're so much better off and all. Now we don't have to say that anymore. Say, look what's happening in Russia. People have been reduced to beggary. Human services have been pretty much abolished. All the public-owned industries are being privatized, all that. Why should we have to tolerate any of that stuff here? Now we're going to stick it to the working class. You people are going to work harder and harder. We're going to get you back to 1900. That is their goal. And the goal against third world nations was much the same. Often aid was given to third world nations, an attempt to develop a middle class in these nations, stability, to make sure some level of prosperity, some little visibility points of prosperity so that these countries, what? Would not go communist. Now they got nowhere else to go. Those programs are being dropped. There is opposition, though. And the goal is to build up these coalitions, build a base of opinion, do these two things. One, you organize horizontally, and also you impact and organize vertically. You take that base. It's not one, two step. Those two are going on simultaneously. And you target our leaders. You target them, our leaders. You target those oil leaders. You target them and you pressure them and you let them know that the people here don't tolerate this kind of regression. They don't think they're not interested in your opinions. Oh, my friends, they're so interested. Oh, my friends, they're so interested. They follow, they listen, they bring people. I don't know who he is. I don't want to point him out. And maybe that clean-cut guy there, I don't know. But they track, they listen, they tap our phones, they do all these things. They are so keenly worried. They know that they stand on our shoulders, and if we begin to move and rumble and really get it together, they begin to really sway and shake up there. Remember, brothers and sisters, when the people are ready to lead, the leaders will eventually follow. Thank you very much.
You heard highlights of Michael Parenti's September 2002 Santa Cruz talk on terrorism and globalization. Parenti is one of the country's most prolific political thinkers. His most recent books are Against Empire, The Terrorism Trap, and The Assassination of Julius Caesar. His writings are translated into over 12 languages. You can contact Michael Parenti via his website, www.michaelparenti.org. That's michaelparenti.org. I hope you have a pen handy to take down a phone number. You can find more information on Michael Parenti and a listing of archival speeches on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. You can get information how to order a 70-minute unedited copy of the complete talk by Michael Parenti on terrorism and globalization by calling us. TUC Radio is listener-supported and free to all radio stations. Your tape order helps us stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape by mail or credit card, by phone, or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.